Every year, more wildlife-friendly habitat disappears from Iowa, and many different species are paying the price. This hour, we'll talk about wildlife corridors and our roadside prairies. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, along with Rebecca Cowton, Program Manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management in Iowa. We'll talk about the species that are suffering because of a lack of habitat, and more specifically, a lack of connecting habitat. We'll also talk about the history of our roadside prairies and the pros and cons of having these natural places along our roadways. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now, maybe the biggest concern for individual wild animals in Iowa is finding enough to eat and keeping warm. But for Iowa wildlife in general, the biggest threat is loss of habitat. This hour, we'll talk about that threat and some innovative ways to combat the problem. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is back with us today. Hello, Jim.
Hello. How are you this morning?
I'm cold.
Yeah, exactly. You know, my wife and I have been watching, I think, like many Americans and people around the world have been watching the Winter Olympics and marveling at the athletic abilities of so many. It's just incredible and almost inspiring to watch, actually. Mm-hmm. And as I was standing outside this morning with my dogs, it was 15 below, and I began to marvel at all of the critters that are. It's like a constant Winter Olympics for them. They're outside in this day and night, and boy, they with the amount of habitat we have left in Iowa, it is an Olympic feat to even survive the winter, as you mentioned in your introduction.
Absolutely,
it's just incredible. So.
Well, and we haven't had as many thaws as we have in recent winters.
That's correct.
Although
yeah.
we do have one in the forecast for next week, so I think we'll all make it through. Maybe
that would be nice.
Most
that
of us. Nice. Also, yeah. I want to mention with us today is Rebecca Cowton. She is Program Manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management in Iowa. She's based at the Tall Grass Prairie Institute at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Rebecca.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And beyond weather, we are going to talk about habitat today. And Jim, this is something you and I have talked about a lot, but it is the greatest threat to wildlife in Iowa. Give us an idea of the bigger picture of habitat loss in the state.
Yeah, if we look at certainly the history of Iowa, our listeners know we've talked many times about how this was the tall grass prairie state. About 85% of the state was covered with a very great mixture of tall grass prairie from wet prairie to mesic or middle prairie to dry prairie as you move in the uplands. And of course, interspersed along the rivers, there were treed corridors, sort of a gallery forest along many of our rivers and streams. And so it was a very, very rich. In fact, Jim Dinsmore wrote the book, A Country So Full of Game, that talked about the history of wildlife in Iowa. The early European explorers here marveled at the numbers of species and the numbers of individuals of species that we had. But, of course, we've changed that from a tall grass prairie state into a different tall grass corn that we grow. Agriculture has dominated the state for a long, long time. But it's really in recent years that we've seen terrific loss. We've had, I think all of us take pride, and we've done this a number of times in the program, take pride in the wildlife species that we've brought back from the brink of extinction, everything from deer in Iowa that were absent, just over a century ago, gone from the state due to unregulated market hunting. Turkeys, otter, bald eagles. We've marveled at a lot of these, and rightfully so. We've brought them back, but we're seeing a different kind of thing that's happening on the landscape, especially in the last 3 years, and that's the loss of the small areas, the little things that are left, and it's a much more gradual and in many ways more insidious loss than killing a bunch of them off as our ancestors did in the late 1800s, because this is a death by starvation, by lack of habitat, by exposure, as we've ground up, especially in the last couple of years, the little areas, the little farmsteads that used to, you know, be abandoned, and we say, well, it's an old barn, it's an old house. But it also, all that area around it was wonderful wildlife habitat. All the fence rows that are now missing have been taken out to get in one more row of row crop. All the little small woodlots that jutted out into fields from fence rows and roadsides, they all seem to be disappearing in the quest to get one more row of corn or beans in. And that has cumulatively a huge impact on wildlife, because it means that those little habitat areas are gone. And what we need in order to connect the few large areas that are left are corridors of habitat that are relatively safe for wildlife species, not only to hide in or to migrate through, but to have some level of connection with other members of their species. Birds, of course, can fly from one area to the other. Some insects can, but lots of other things, mammals, small mammals, lots of insects, spiders, all kinds of things can't do that. So the corridors that roadsides provide have become really been elevated in importance, I would say, over the last couple of decades, as a matter of fact, but especially in the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, and that's a perfect place to bring Rebecca into the conversation, because, of course, these roadsides have changed a lot in the last couple of decades. When I was growing up, roadsides in Iowa were not only mowed, they were also sprayed. So, Rebecca, when did this start to change? When did the idea of actually providing habitat for wildlife along the roadsides come into being?
The concept for integrated roadside vegetation management, or IRVM, as we know it, really came about in the late 1980s. There were three main factors that drove the inception of this program and this management style as far as our roadsides are concerned. And a lot of that was driven by three main factors. The general economy of the 1980s, especially in Iowa, was pretty economically depressed. And so looking at ways to save money for both state and local road maintenance budgets was a huge factor. When you think of how much mowing and spraying was being done, if you were mowing every inch of roadside, if you were spraying every acre, that was a significant impact to your local budget or your state budget. On top of that, in the late 1980s, the federal legislature, the Congress of the U.S. passed what was known as the Federal Groundwater Protection Act, and counties and state agencies were having to take a look at their practices and the impacts to groundwater, particularly looking at the amount of spraying that was being done in public right-of-way. The third main factor that helped create IRVM as we know it today was the development of the Resource Enhancement and Protection Program, or as many of us know it as REAP. When that program was passed by the Iowa legislature, 3% of the overall funding for REAP as a program in the state legislature is, to this day, a funding mechanism for IRVM in Iowa. So when you think about, like this year, this past year, REAP was funded at $16 million in the state legislature. 3% of that went toward integrated roadside vegetation management through what's known as the Iowa Living Roadway Trust Fund. And the Iowa DOT, Department of Transportation, manages the Living Roadway Trust Fund, and they match those REAP dollars with other state and federal money to provide a funding mechanism for counties and cities and other groups around the state to be able to manage their roadsides. And taking into account, you know, the economics of planting perennial vegetation, we recommend, you know, native vegetation whenever possible, simply because you get not only the cost-effective benefit of you're not mowing as much, you're not spraying as much, but also the ecological benefit. We're able to restore at least a portion of that original native vegetation that was here on the North American prairie landscape, and provide that refuge and provide that habitat as we had it, as Jim said, before settlement and what Iowa originally looked like, centuries ago.
Well, you mentioned how much effort was put into mowing and spraying these roadways, but establishing a tall grass prairie along a roadside isn't exactly something that happens without effort. What does it take to get something established?
Absolutely. There does need to be ground prep. You know, if it's bare soil or wherever you're going to be seeding, you've got to make sure you've got that seed to soil contact. Many counties and the DOT use either seed drills, or a lot of counties and DOT in some places have gone to hydro seeding, where they'll spray the seed on with like a paper mulch to allow it to basically stick to the soil. And it's not a case where you just seed it and then you're done. Depending on the locations, you're going to probably have to do some mowing to keep some of the weeds at bay. If you've got annual weeds, if you want to keep them from developing seed heads, so they don't spread. And again, we do still spray, but it's a lot less than what we used to, and it's very selective, and it's trying to knock down those nuisance species to keep the prairie going.
How many miles of roadways have been transformed in this way?
Well, we talk in acres a lot of times when you think of roadsides, and when you think of the acreage across Iowa, we have about 750,000 acres of roadsides, and that includes state roads, county roads, everything from paved to gravel. And within that, we've got about 4 to 6 acres per mile. So what we're looking at is about 750,000 acres total of what we're working with. And depending on the county and depending on the program, we've been able, at least through the UNI roadside program, we've been able to establish a program here where we have seed since 1998 to seed up to 15,000 acres of that overall number of acres to native prairie. And when you match that with probably about 20,000 or so that the DOT has also seeded through their own programs, through some revegetation programs where they took out non-native grasses and put back native grasses. It's a small percentage, but it's a growing number, and we're continuing each year.
So we've got over 89,000 miles of secondary roads in the state, and many of those, not all, but many of those now are planted back to native plant species. Great for native animal species as well.
And we will talk more about that in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. With me today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's also emeritus associate professor in the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University and a consultant. Rebecca Cowton is here. She's program manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about wildlife habitat in Iowa. And with me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease and Rebecca Cowton, who's program manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management in the state. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. And Jim, of course, planting these native grasses along our roadsides is important for the native plant species, mm-hmm. for sure.
Right.
and when I was a kid, I remember when people were first starting to get into prairie reconstruction, we would go to roadsides in the country to try to collect seeds in places where some of these native plants had actually
those neglected roadsides.
Right, exactly.
Right? So-called. Right?
Exactly. Now, let's talk about the importance of these roadsides in terms of wildlife corridors. What species benefit from having a natural strip along the roadside?
Well, virtually anything that can that needs to be in contact with the members of its fellow species benefits from the roadsides. Now, there are lots of ways to benefit. Of course, wildlife needs food, water, and cover. And roadsides can provide some of that, particularly if they're planted in native plants. So it's not just grasses. It's grasses and forbs. And in some cases, along some of the primary highways, if we look at our interstate system, they planted shrubs in strategic places and some trees. All of that can provide some either food, water, or shelter, food or shelter for wildlife species. And it includes virtually just about every Iowa species you can imagine that will use prairie and one that is tolerant of human interference, especially traffic. And that includes everything from small mice, lots and lots of insects and spiders, butterflies, up to foxes and coyotes and deer and all the things that need a corridor of habitat, not of just open field, but of habitat that they can migrate through, live in, or contact members of their own species.
There are some people who look at these roadsides and think, isn't it more dangerous for wildlife to be living right along a roadside? Is there a concern that we're creating habitat right next to what can be a lethal weapon for wildlife?
Absolutely. There's a big concern about that. And if that's the only habitat left, they don't have any choice. And in fact, it does become a hazard to them. There's no question. It is, and that's what's concerning. I think the figures are, if you look at the loss, you know, at one point at the peak of the Conservation Reserve Program, what's commonly known as CRP in Iowa, we had 2.2 million acres of CRP planted in Iowa. And due to various things in the Farm Bill, the elevation of the value of land, the elevation of the value of corn and soybeans, and the inability of federal payments to keep up with the rental value even of farmland, a lot of that CRP has disappeared. And we've lost grasslands. I think the calculation that I've seen is a strip of land approximately 8 miles wide that runs from Council Bluffs, the equivalent, that runs from Council Bluffs clear to Davenport. So from coast to coast in Iowa. So we've lost that many acres of grassland in the last 5, 6, or 7 years now as CRP has disappeared and it's been put back into row crop. It'll be really interesting to see with the Farm Bill finally passed, the 2011 Farm Bill, by the way, finally passed in 2014. It's a whole other program on that. it'll be interesting to see how much CRP comes back and how much landowners respond to that. I'm hopeful, but it remains to be seen, of course.
Now, most of us, when we think about Iowa wildlife, we tend to think about the larger, more charismatic creatures. But this kind of habitat can be incredibly important for some of the smaller creatures that we don't think about as much, including insects, right?
Oh, absolutely. Pollinators in particular. But again, as you mentioned earlier, it can be it's a dangerous zone. There's no question. If they cross, when a car or a truck is coming by, they end up on your windshield or in your grill, and that doesn't help necessarily either. But you know, let me give you an example. There's a recent study, a monarch study that I just saw a week ago, that showed a direct correlation. Monarch numbers that migrate, and some of our listeners know if they've listened to this program and the Friday program on gardening, that in fact monarch populations are that overwinter in Mexico are down a tremendous amount. It's the smallest they've ever recorded. in modern history, the number of migrants there. And I think a lot of Iowans notice this the last year or two, especially the lack of monarchs that were around through the summertime. Now, part of that is drought in Texas and things like that. There's no question that climate change weather patterns have had an impact. But it goes beyond that, because the research that I saw showed that there was this direct correlation between loss of milkweed plants, those in the Asclepias genus, over the years, loss of habitat that grows a lot. We allow milkweeds to grow, and the loss of monarch populations, because monarchs, of course, lay their eggs and the larvae eat what to most insect species is a poisonous plant, the milky juices of all members of that genus are actually poisonous to insects. But the monarchs have figured out a way genetically to overcome that, and so milkweed is a very important food to them. So but we've lost more and more of those areas. It used to grow commonly. It was a common weed in many of our fields, but as herbicides have gotten much more effective, we've had that disappear as a competitor from our crop fields. So where are the places that they can grow? Well, roadsides are one of those important places for many species of milkweed, from the beautiful butterfly, bright orange butterfly milkweed, through swamp milkweed, through the common milkweed that we see sometimes in unmowed areas, become critical habitat and critical needs for things like monarch butterflies. And there are lots of other plants like that, too, that can grow on these roadsides.
Now, a few months ago, when entomologist Donald Lewis was on the show and we were talking about monarchs, somebody called the show and said, you know, in the CRP-approved mixes that people get to plant native grasses on their lands, there's no milkweed included in the mixes. Rebecca, with the native grass mixes or the native plant mixes that you plant along the roadsides, do you specifically make sure that milkweed is part of that?
We do. We include the showy and the butterfly milkweed, the swamp milkweed and the butterfly milkweed in the mixes that we provide through the Transportation Alternatives Program. The seed we provide to the counties for their plantings. And recently we were actually looking at the quantities in our mixes, and the current mix, the CP25 mix that's typically used for CRP plantings that Jim's referring to, they do include it, but it's in very small quantities.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And what we found is the seed mix that we generate for county roadside distribution has 10 times the concentration of milkweed species in our mix compared to the CRP mixes.
Interesting. We're talking about wildlife habitat and wildlife habitat along our roadsides today on Talk of Iowa. With me, Rebecca Cowton. She is Program Manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management in Iowa, based at the Tallgrass Prairie Institute at the University of Northern Iowa. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with us again today. He comes by once a month, of course. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bill is on the line in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call, and thank you to Rebecca and Dr. Pease as well.
You bet.
I have noticed over the past several years on many of the state highways, now these are the state highways, that there is frequent mowing and subsequent haying of the ditches by farmers. And many of them have planted, many of these ditches and miles have been planted to native vegetation only to be mowed and hayed during the entire growing season. And that's including the bird nesting times as well. Mm. And I've seen this done for miles, not just an occasional place here and there, but just literally miles. Could you comment on the advisability of the Iowa DOT tolerating or allowing this to be done on the state-owned highways?
I'll comment first, and then Rebecca, you can chime in with your knowledge of this. It's certainly can be very problematic if it is done after July 15th, it's not a problem or as much of a problem in terms of wildlife. You might get a few re-nesters or second nesters in terms of birds. Wildlife, other species of wildlife, particularly insects, it can still be problematic at that time, but maybe obviously the later you go, the less of a problem it is. Most of the raising of young is done. It does, anytime it is done, it does eliminate wintering habitat, no question about it, and even habitat that's needed in late falls, early winters as well. So that it can be a problem. On the other hand, I realize that one of the reasons they do it is there are certain weed laws in Iowa, and they have to control what are called noxious weeds and the plants that are on that list. At the same time, there's often some training that's needed, and I've seen this certainly in many counties across the state. As we provided more and more training, and Rebecca does this, helps on this through her program, to roadside managers so that they can correctly identify the species that are there, there gets to be less mowing that happens. And as she said, the other thing is that during the establishment first couple of years of some of these areas, then some planting or some mowing is useful to the native species. Native species tend to put their roots down first, and in order to get enough sunlight and less competition from annual things that are also in there, in the soil, the seed bank that's there, a little mowing helps the native species along, but only for the first couple of years. Rebecca, you wanna comment some more on that?
Sure. Also, within the state of Iowa, we have, like you said, we have a state mowing law that does prohibit mowing before July 15th for the purpose of providing refuge for nesting birds. But it also allows Iowa DOT actually has a permit system for mowing for the purposes of haying. And I know there was a stretch of road of state highway I saw last year, and I actually commented. I contacted someone at DOT, and sure enough, the hay bales were through multiple permits that were generated by the Department of Transportation. And so when we do see that, if it's on, especially if it's on state right of way, more than likely there was probably a permit that was provided to allow that. But if not, if it was before that July 15th deadline or August 15th deadline, when haying is the August 15th deadline, a lot of that really comes down to local enforcement too. You know, it's one thing to have a law in the books; it's another thing to have it enforced. but that said, you know, sometimes the mowing at the end of season, especially on state right of way, has to also do with human health and safety, mm-hmm. And visibility. So, you know, we do want to see native grasses and wildflowers whenever possible along the right of way, but especially on state highways, the primary roads where you've got a lot of vehicle traffic. We have to always keep in mind that human health and safety comes first. And when one of the things I didn't mention early on, too, is part of the things that our roadside managers do also is we protect and manage remnants, not just the areas that we plant. And these are the areas that are, you know, some of those small little pockets of remaining native prairie. And the thing is, on state roads, on the major highways, we don't really see those as often because that's typically been disturbed to make these bigger roadways. So haying and mowing can be a management practice incorporated in managing our vegetation on these state highways. But yeah, if you're not sure, you can always check with the DOT and see if there's a permit.
Bill, thank you so much for your call. And Rebecca, can you explain that law a little bit more clearly to us? The July 15th date for not mowing roadways before that, does that apply to homeowners? What is the blanket there?
I can certainly try.
Okay.
The state mowing law was something that was passed back in 2010, and it's a law that basically sets up that July 15th no mow date, saying we want to be able to protect habitat as much as we can for nesting birds and our pollinator species before that date to provide for nesting. And it also, again, creates the structure for DOT to have a permit-based system for haying and mowing. Their date that they set up is August 15th, of looking at when haying is allowed. The law has 9 exceptions. I don't have them memorized, but it ranges from you're allowed to mow within 200 yards in either direction of an acreage where you're living. You're allowed to mow in front of seed test plots. You're allowed to mow in front of tile intakes. You're allowed to mow in front of driveways for visibility and safety purposes. But again, I can't rattle them all off verbatim. But you can certainly look up the state mowing law in the Iowa code.
And you mentioned enforcement. Do you see much enforcement of this law?
It depends on where you are. The one thing that the law didn't include was the structure of how to enforce it. So that's one thing that we're actually since the last couple of months we've started a mowing law working group to bring folks together, whether it's county roadside managers and county engineers, soil and water conservation district folks, and just talking about this to see what's the best method of enforcing or complying with this law. And we had our first meeting this last month, and the discussion in my mind seems to be going toward we need to be looking at local policy, whether it's local ordinances or developing mowing policies based on the structure of the weed law to determine what's going to work best for each county, because right now there's no statewide structure as far as enforcement.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Today we're talking about wildlife habitat in Iowa, and specifically wildlife habitat corridors, including our roadways in the state. With me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease and Rebecca Cowton, program manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management in the state. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about wildlife habitat in the state of Iowa and some innovative ways to create more habitat when so much is being lost. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's also Emeritus Associate Professor in the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University and an environmental interpretive and wildlife consultant based in Ames.
I want you to say that 3 times very fast.
Maybe next time. I'm Jim.
Okay.
Rebecca Cowton is also here. She's program manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management in Iowa, based at the Tallgrass Prairie Institute at the University of Northern Iowa. All right, I'm going to stop talking now. We're going to get to the phones now. We have a number of people who want to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Ken is on the line in Pocahontas County. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I guess the last comment about local management seems to be very important. We live up here, basically a pothole wetland area that's been drained, and I'm one of those parties that has mowed road ditches for several years, probably about 10, and I've tried to manage them with a little local spot spraying. But the thing I notice is that as far as habitat along a busy highway, I spend a lot of time out there, I virtually never see any habitat or any wildlife. The bottom of the road ditch, since we are in a swamp area, is often underwater in the first part of the spring when the nesting takes place. And there's also an issue of encroachment by landowners on the road ditch. Most of the habitat is actually next to the field, and if you'll notice in a lot of counties, they're actually farming the road ditch. And I know some counties regulate this pretty heavily and give fines, and others don't. And I was wondering if it'd be more cost-effective to do these projects on the gravel roads that are less traveled and less disruptive to wildlife. And that's all the comments I have. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Ken.
Great, great questions. Certainly wildlife are there, and I know Ken said that he spends a lot of time out there, and that's exactly what we need, those kinds of comments from folks. Many species are there, of course. You may not see the larger species, but there are lots of small mammals that spend most of their time in the duff or underneath the duff in tunnel systems that are just below. The duff is that the dead plant matter that lays on top of the soil. And if that roadside isn't burned frequently, and there are often burning regimes that counties use to help manage those areas. But if it's not burned frequently, that duff builds up over 2-3 years and provides hiding areas, nesting habitat, all kinds of things. It is true. What he said, I think, is a great observation. I think a lot of people have noticed this, particularly as commodity prices have gone up over the last few years. There is a lot of encroachment. Now, it depends on the ownership of the roadside. This varies from area to area, from county to county, and from even within a county, from road to road, because there is it depends on the air, on the road. Some of that is actually privately owned to the middle of the road, and some of it is not. Some of it is county road, county-owned, or in the case of state highways, is state-owned. So it really varies a whole lot as to the ownership of that that land. Encroachment, and we've seen this where the plow seems to be, or the planting seems to be swinging more and more into the ditch, even between the telephone poles, that, you know, the power poles that are along the side of the road. There is a lot of encroachment, and certainly some of the best upland habitat is on that field side of the ditch, higher up on that area. But it's not the only habitat. There are a wide variety of species we're talking about here.
Rebecca, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Sure. When it comes to the program I manage here at UNI, at the Tallgrass Prairie Center, I primarily work with the county IRVM managers, whether it's in the County Secondary Roads Program, County Conservation Board, or County Engineering Department. And our focus primarily is those gravel roads and the paved county roads. We don't focus as much on the major thoroughfares. We leave that to Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. And so he's exactly right. The higher quality habitat, Ken, the caller, is exactly right. The higher quality habitat, and oftentimes the remnant prairies that we find, are on these gravel roads or on these less traveled roads, and those are the ones we want to be sure we manage properly to be able to maintain those. To add to that, when it comes to who has the right to the right-of-way, one of the things that's come out of the discussion with our mowing law working group, and we're getting into this in a little more detail, so I can't speak with full certainty, but the discussion has been looking into a rule that was changed by the state assessor's office, back in the 1960s, because there was this confusion of who owns to the middle of the road, who owns the ditch, and whether it is owned outright by the private landowner or the public agency, because there's an easement for maintenance and management, same way you have utility easements when you're in town. The tax assessment is not based on that right-of-way. So even if you own it, you're not paying taxes on that strip of land, because the maintenance and management of it is left to the local government agency.
And not every county, I want to make clear, not every county in the state has an IRVM, an Integrated
right.
Roadside Vegetation Management. Isn't it 89 counties, Rebecca? Isn't that correct?
We've got 89 counties that have participated in the seed purchase. At some point in time since 1998. We've got about 60 counties statewide that have that are doing IRVM in some capacity. I'm very proud to say that both Sac County and Pocahontas County, from our two callers, both have county roadside managers. So if they have any other questions, they can contact their local roadside manager.
All right. We have a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Joe is up next in Iowa City. Hi, Joe.
Hi. One of the joys of growing up in the summer in Iowa was the wild rose along the roadside. And we pretty well wiped them out. Are they a noxious weed now, or are we making some effort to reinstall those?
Yeah, it's a state flower, the wild rose, exactly. And that's one of the benefits, of course, that these native roadsides bring, is this incredible splash of color that is available when you plant prairie all throughout the growing season. It's just wonderful. It changes each time. And our state plant, Rebecca, what about the planting mixes? Do you have rose hips, native rose hips in there?
We do not include include Rosa Arkansana, which is the state rose, in our roadside mix. Again, it gets back to the mix that is used in the roadside plantings, like you said earlier, is about resilience. You want to be able to plant something that is going to be drought tolerant, flood tolerant, you know, that's going to be able to withstand salt applications as well.
Yeah.
The question I would have for the caller is, is it the native rose or the multiflora rose that they're looking for?
Because, not multiflora,
okay.
No.
Because that's actually been a success story for IRVM. Is
over-success.
Well, but for management, being able to, yes, to manage the, because multiflora roses, some folks may not know, that's actually considered a nuisance species. But yeah, as far as the wild rose, we don't include that in the mix, but that's not to say it's not out there in remnants and on your gravel roads and on your secondary roads.
And I would say that for so many years, we sprayed chemicals or herbicides that took care of broadleaf plants, including such things as wild rose.
Absolutely.
So for so many years, our roadsides were sprayed, and it's very difficult. It's one of the reasons these programs that Rebecca runs and the state runs, but also protecting those individual remnants that you know about, having a source of the seed for those is really, really critical, and lots of individual landowners are really, really important in that effort.
Well, and let's talk about individual landowners, and not just large landowners either. Do you have recommendations, Jim, for people who may be on 2 or 3 acres out in the country and have some ditch of their own? What can people do to make a difference?
Well, you can. There are a number of ways to go. One is to contact your local roadside vegetation manager, if you have one. Sometimes, as Rebecca said, sometimes they are in with the County Conservation Board. That's true here in Story County. They're an employee of the County Conservation Board. Sometimes they're connected with the Secondary Roads Office in your county, and sometimes they're connected with the County Engineer's Office. It varies quite a bit across the state, local control issues. And so talk to them and say, you know, I'd really like my roadside ditch to be included in this program. And they may not be able to get to it right away because I know here in Central Iowa, there's a lot of demand for it, a lot of people wanting their roadsides to be that kind of planting instead of solid brome. They may not get to it right away or in the current year. You can also then order seed yourself and plant your own roadside through the many prairie seed sources. I've done that in our ditch in front of our house. I put it in prairie myself. I didn't wait for it to be done. And I got sometimes the roadside manager or the roadside programs will provide some seed to you if you're willing to do it yourself, and you can get it done a little quicker. But again, pay attention to those management issues. There is an extension publication that could contact their county extension office. It's called Managing Iowa Habitats Prairies, and it talks about how to plant them, how often they need to be mowed in the first year or two, what to expect, what are some suggested seed mixes, those sorts of things.
Craig is on the line in Denver. Hello, Craig.
Hi.
Hi.
You folks may have just answered my question somewhat, but in listening, I guess I'm working on the premise that if you build it, they will come. So with that type of thinking, I'm concerned about the kind of metrics that are being put in place by the DNR, the extension people of the state, to evaluate what they're doing. What do they have out there that evaluates the kinds of things that are put in place that it does create more habitat, or is it just common sense that that's going to happen? And then where can I go to find that information out?
Yeah, there's a couple. That's a great question because evaluating the success of the program, one is in the from the aesthetic standpoint, it's in the eye of the beholder, certainly. And some will value that roadside and in native vegetation, some will not. But if you're thinking specifically in terms of wildlife, there are a number of studies that have gone on over the years. Whether they're available online or not anymore, I'm not certain. We, for example, were asked to evaluate the wildlife mortality particularly of small mammals and birds. So when I was Extension Wildlife Specialist, we had a program called a Nature Mapping Program, which is sort of in hiatus right now. But we asked our nature mappers, which were spread out across the state, to take a look at roadkill. It was a big roadkill study that DOT, the asked us to do, the Living Roadway Trust Fund asked us to do. And what we found in that program by looking at roadkills and then comparing it to native versus non-native roadside is that, it was a fairly small study in terms of numbers, so I won't say that it is totally representative. But the roadkill, and this is always fun to think about driving along the road looking for roadkill, that it was more associated with the topography of an area, the roadkill was, rather than the vegetation that was right next to it. In other words, they were often crossing at the low point when a road dips down into an area because those are, become regular corridors anyway, that was much more important than the vegetation that was on the immediate roadside. The other thing we notice is that the vegetation beyond that, if there were treed corridors in particular, they were much more likely to be roadkill on that area. And for roadkill, we're looking commonly at deer, raccoons, squirrels, possums, that sort of thing. And, of course, many of those are associated with wooded areas. And the topography then dictated where the trees were as well. So that's one study. There have also been a number of insect studies that are done using roadsides and tracking insects, and those there's some national studies as well. Where you can find them, I would say start online and do a Google search or a Bing search or whatever to see if you can locate those kinds of studies.
So we have just a moment left, and, you know, of course, not a lot of people have a lot of roadway, but even the kind of habitat we can plant in our own yard can make a difference, right?
Oh, absolutely. And diversity is the key, and the connections to other between areas is really, really important. And again, as we look at a roadside today, these roadsides, although right now many of the roadsides in the state are filled with snow, the other areas that connect the corridors or connect the big habitat areas, these corridor areas become very, very important, including your own backyard.
We've been talking about wildlife habitat today on Talk of Iowa. Rebecca Cowton, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Rebecca Cowton is Program Manager for Integrated Roadside Vegetation Management in Iowa. She's based at the Tallgrass Prairie Institute at the University of Northern Iowa. And Jim, before you leave, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, a lot of individual wild animals are just concerned about keeping warm and finding enough to eat this time of year. And River to River host Ben Kiefer has a question for you about some of those critters.
Okay. In fact, Jim, as I was crossing the Iowa River, a bridge over the Iowa River, I snapped a shot that's available on our Facebook page. Page of, oh, I don't know, 200-300 geese huddled in the water that is steaming, and I have to believe this water is just above freezing, steaming in the minus 2 Fahrenheit weather.
Exactly.
It's on our Facebook page. Have a look for it. It looks like another planet's landscape, actually. How do they do it, Jim?
It is amazing. They have an amazing set of feathers that are carefully preened with oils that will make those feathers waterproof. The feathers then provide dead air spaces beneath them, which insulate their body. They also reduce the blood flow to their feet. So you see a lot of these geese standing on the ice, standing on one foot. The other foot is tucked up in that that heavy goose down. So they grow their own goose down coats, as it were. But the other foot, they reduce the blood flow in such a way, and they have the arteries and veins are such that they're not losing heat out the bottom of their feet.
I will never complain about getting up and going to a nice warm studio to work.
Go out in the bare feet.
Well, Jim, thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon. Enjoy your trip to Florida, by the way.
Will do.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease joins us once a month. And, Ben, what's coming up on River to River today?
Coming up, two wonderful individuals. Michelle Norris will be on the first half of the program at noon, and then Soledad O'Brien, conversations about race in America with both of them.
All right. That's coming up on River to River today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.